This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 21st of December 2014 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Weekly is brought to you in association with Persol. Hello and welcome to edition 285 of the Monocle Weekly in association with Persol here on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
Coming up on today's programme, Christmas is just under 4 days away, but what's on your menu? Renowned chef James Ferguson from London's Beagle restaurant will join us to debate goose versus turkey and preview a few of his food predictions for 2015.
Then American writer Norman Mailer once claimed his famous essay on John F. Kennedy's 1960 campaign won the future president the election. Now Mailer's piece has been transformed by publisher Taschen into a weighty and gorgeous book chock full of photographs. We'll meet the editor.
And later in the show, we'll ask former magazine founder, publisher and think tanker Eden Collinsworth why she moved to China and how a guide on Western etiquette became a bestseller.
All that, plus, of course, our look ahead to the stories that are sure to set the news agenda during the week to come. That's all up here on the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24. Are you sure it's edition 285 of the Monocle Weekly? Andrew, have you done the math? Have you worked it out?
I have. I'm just thinking about...
So it's 285th Monocle Weekly we've done this week.
I think surely. So. I'm thinking about goose versus turkey. There's a fight.
Goose versus turkey. You know that there's some GIF doing the rounds called goose versus turkey, right? And it's... Let's put it this way. You want to delete your internet search history.
I prefer a goosing to a bit of a...
What's going to happen in this... as a vegetarian, Andrew, what do you think is going to happen in this show? I'm going to be... As Father Christmas. Yeah, you're going to be Slim Jim.
I'm going to have my feet up, maybe picking at the odd Brussels sprout that comes my way.
I hope you bring some wine in. I think at this point in the week...
I hope he brings a goose and a turkey in. Real live ones. Gobbling under the table.
Don't make any choking chicken jokes.
We'll move on.
Yeah, my parents listen to this.
Okay.
They're worried.
And now you're Mr. and Mrs. Bound as well.
Yeah,
you've got to grow up a bit, haven't you?
I have got to grow up a bit, exactly.
Okay.
I can't be making these silly sexual puns. I've got to all stop. All I want for Christmas is my wife back in the country. That'd be nice, wouldn't it?
Let's see what UK immigration can do for you.
I hope no one from that august organisation, who I love and who have been exceptionally helpful throughout the process, listen to this programme.
But they have been kind of helpful.
Sort of. What are we going to do first? We're going to revert to traditional style. We're going to get Tom Edwards out of his news closet. Here he comes.
From Monocle's editorial floor comes the world's hardest-hitting journalist.
Like a cuddly newsman. That's the effect I'm looking for.
He has uncompromising standards.
That's right, I'm setting the bar that low.
And is never afraid to expose new ideas. It's Tom Edwards with the news look ahead.
Sometimes you've got to stick with what you know.
Well, you don't know much.
Here he is.
We've laughed at that joke all year.
Yeah, I always forget that there's that little bit on the end and I like it.
That's right. A little extra nugget of, you know, insulting behaviour. It's perfect.
Monocle's current affairs lion, Tom Edwards, joins us.
I'll take it.
Yeah.
Hear me roar.
Yeah, okay. What's going to happen in 2016? You've got
2 15.
Minutes.
You've jumped a year ahead.
I know, I've done quite a lot of look-aheads this week, and I feel a bit confused as to what year it is.
I can't even think about 2016 yet.
Sorry.
Frankly, I'm not going to talk about 2015 either.
Is this a review of 2014?
No, we're doing...
Okay, next week.
Next week's news.
Okay.
Right.
And it is mainly... it's all 2014.
Yeah. Okay.
No, there's no turkey basting going on. Let's start. So I've got a few interesting little things. One, this really struck me. There's something tomorrow. The Interoceanic Grand Canal construction begins tomorrow.
Where's that?
In Nicaragua.
Oh.
$50 billion project. And the idea is this is going to be some kind of rival to, you know, the Panama Canal. It's been mooted for a long time. Mm. But a number of sort of feasibility studies, hugely complex. 172 miles. There's a Hong Kong-based sort of conglomerate who are in charge of the construction project. And it'll change, you know, water supplies. It'll change all these, you know, transport logistics. And it will go through Lake Nicaragua, Central America's largest lake.
And why are they building it? Do we know?
Well, it's going to be transformative for Nicaragua, clearly. It makes sense for them.
They love it, don't they, having a... Well, it lots of boats stop. People buy probably like a bag of crisps and things like that.
Exactly.
Big money.
Pint of milk.
Stuff like that. Stop off.
But I guess, I don't know. I think the idea, it's sort of bigger and wider than the Panama. It's supposed to be better than the Panama Canal.
Better than the Panama. What are the key sort of qualities of a canal, do you think? Straightness.
Depth. Is depth. Width. For the larger vessels.
Yeah.
Depth. I think depth is very important because, you know, we're in the age, Andrew, of the super tanker. And we've gone beyond the super tanker even.
Even the
Panama. You addressed Andrew there as if he's always doubting that we're in the age of anything, let alone the supertanker. Trying to convince Andrew that we're in the age of the supertanker.
I think we're beyond. What's a supertanker?
I think he was implying that I only just get through the door frame these days. Big door frame.
It's difficult
your
this
hips.
Time of year. It's difficult this time of year. Anyway, I think that's interesting. That's a kind of, you know, it's infrastructure, it's logistics, it's interesting.
It is good, yeah. Like
if you're in the pickaxe business.
Yeah, get cracking. I think you'll need a more heavy-duty machinery. Maybe we can lend them some of the stuff that was outside Midori House.
Oh, my God.
The digging that's been going on next door. Oh,
I think they're tunnelling beneath.
Maybe that's part of the actual digging for the Nicaragua Canal.
You're going to pop up here with some super tankers.
I've seen a man with a hat with corks on it. I'm sure they've reached Australia.
Yeah, where did he come from? He can't have made his way through the core. It's too hot.
Next,
let's get a bit more seasonal. On Tuesday, a giant Christmas tree shaped tower is being illuminated by the South Koreans near the border with the North. It's 60 feet, and the South, they'd worried that it wasn't safe, but now they're going to go for it.
Okay.
So people gather and sing hymns, and the idea being everyone on the,
it's
you know,
it's
on
a
the
peace
north
thing,
side.
So it's a north and south.
I don't think it's a peace thing. I think it's like two fingers up. Yeah. It's kind of a provocation. And there was some discussion. It's come up in like discussions whether that, you know, if they didn't do it, would they be more likely to have friendship with the North? Hmm. The North doesn't like it.
No. Well, there's still occasionally, you know, little pot shots, literally pot shots that are taken across the sort of 38th parallel or whatever it is. Mm. But I think it's rather nice. It may be provocative, but I like a gesture of peace at this time of year.
A provocative Christmas tree.
With a little angel drone on the top. When people are not looking, she kind of whizzes over the border, kind of looking down at people.
Have a quick little look over what's occurring. And
exploding
then
baubles.
A little angel on the top flourishing a middle finger.
Metaphorically. But I think that's a nice story. But you're a little cynical.
I'm giving them both 10 out of 10.
Okay, well, how about this? What about La Noche de los Rabano?
The night of the what? The Ray-Bans.
I always wear your sunglasses at night.
This is also how I choose it. No, it's the Ochaca, Mexico's radish carving festival.
Or is that Oaxaca?
Oh,
is that Oaxaca?
Oaxaca,
yeah.
I might say Oaxaca. You say Oaxaca.
What, with an OA? Is that how it's spelled?
Yeah, Oaxaca.
Oaxaca.
Oh, that is Oaxaca, is it?
A radish carving festival.
Yeah.
Okay.
So,
what shapes are they? Is this a sort of Christmas thing? Or?
No, there's no limits. Animals, dancers, saints, conquerors, kings, and other images.
From a radish?
All from a radish. Can you imagine the detail? I mean, maybe it's a massive radish, actually. I hadn't thought of
that. Maybe it's a turnip.
And it's just a Swiss. They just painted it.
Yeah, they claim it.
It started in the late 19th century. And the mayor of the city began the first exhibition of radish art. Obviously not that busy. They start 3 days before to get their little sculptures prepared. Imagine that. What a waste of time.
The worst town in the universe. Imagine that. It's like, oh, come to the radish carving festival.
I know.
Imagine.
But I think, what if they're really detailed little things?
Yeah, they probably are. I'd like to, I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I think we live in the age of the supertanker, and I'd like to see a huge gourd carved into the shape of a big boat.
Supertanker. Yeah. Why not? Maybe they can do that in Oaxaca, or whatever it's called.
Oaxaca.
Now, of course, Thursday's actually, you know, Christmas Day. Mm. I think we should be pursuing sort of largely secular, you know, agenda, but there's a couple of things that are happening around the world. The Harbin Ice and Snow Sculpture Festival, which is always amazing, that's kind of non-denominational. But what does Christmas Day itself mean to you, Robert Bound?
Oh, well, I think it means lots of good food and drink, doesn't it? Mm. I think that's the thing. It means brisk walk.
And it means, yeah, brisk walk in the morning.
Working up an appetite and then sort of, you know, indulging. It's good. That's what it
that's
means
nice.
To me. And also the night before Christmas carols.
Well, if I'm not shaving my radishes...
God.
Then,
you just put two kiwi fruits on the table. That's not.
That's an image. That's an image to behold for 2015, isn't it? Holy Mother.
Okay, what does it mean to you? Ice sculpting.
Very much. I do a bit of ice sculpting, then some reddish sculpting, and then I'll finally sit down.
Actually, do you know, I walked through Somerset House at the weekend, and it was quite early in the day, and there were like kids skating, but kids holding. Have you seen they've got these little penguins?
Oh,
yes, bears.
Yeah, I've seen that. Yeah.
It was so sweet. That was the first, it made me feel quite Christmassy.
Hmm.
Because I always associate a polar bear with Christ at Christmas. That was one of the animals in the manger, wasn't it?
Yeah,
he was there outside. He had to stand outside.
That's global warming for you.
Too warm in there.
Okay.
And I've got a final piece of, classic United Kingdom seasonal esoterica to finish with, because I know we like to go through these. We're going straight to the Orkney Islands. Any advances yet? No? It's the Uppies and Doonies Bar game.
Okay.
I'm not making this up.
At least your pronunciation is better than your Mexican.
Marginally, yeah. It's played every Christmas New Year's Day in Kirkwall and Orkney. It's like the sort of mass football games, beloved provincial town. So
yeah.
Sort of two villages. It's basically an excuse to have a massive, legitimised punch-up. And it's been played in its current form since 1850, but for a lot longer than that, probably going back into sort of...
Does it involve a ball? Is it a game of football?
Yeah. No, but yeah. I don't know, it's kind of... mass football-ish. It's often played with, like we mentioned, gourds, like a gourd or an animal stomach or something like that. So it might not be a conventional ball, like a football, for example, but some kind of ball is used.
It's almost head. Probably.
It can go on for us. Could be or like that.
Millwall versus Chelsea.
Goat body game.
Properly intense. Okay,
Pretty extraordinary. And I think if any of our listeners are maybe in the Orkney Isles or stopping by, maybe not. On top of their seasonal hit list, maybe take part. But you'd have to ally yourself with either the Uppies or the Doonies.
Okay.
I kind of like the things like that. I wish they were on the TV.
I would definitely watch that.
But a great sort of, Boxing Day is a great sort of fixture for sporting occasions, isn't it? Lots of big football matches. Mm. I want to see that.
Uppies and Doonies.
Sky Sports 1, HD, 3-hour brawl.
It's probably on Fox or something.
It probably
already is.
Tom, I loved that.
There you go. Well, best.
That's the last news look ahead of 2014.
Yeah, best of.
You've finished in style.
Best of seasonal to you both.
Best of seasonal to you both.
Yeah,
that's the worst. Well, what kind of awful Christmas card do you read that out of?
What's wrong with that?
Best of seasonal.
Yeah, seasonal greetings and that.
Talking of seasoning, I think we're going to have a chef next.
Oh man!
Oh, that was it. Was effortless. It was literally, you put no effort into it. Literally.
From London.
To New York.
To Tokyo.
To Shanghai.
To Berlin.
To Tel Aviv.
To Buenos Aires.
To Toronto.
To Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
You're listening to the Monocle Weekly, and Christmas is just under 4 days away. Now, you might be flying away to meet relatives, or going off on a holiday to some exotic locale, or perhaps you're staying put. But one thing's for sure, you're likely to be eating a lot, and hopefully eating well.
Our first guest today knows all about the finer points of eating well this season. James Ferguson is head chef at Beagle, a critically acclaimed restaurant in London's Hoxton neighbourhood. James joins us now to give us his tips on everything from eating goose versus turkey and what food trends will blow up, it says, in 2015. James, welcome to the programme.
How are you doing, guys?
Very well. And I'm looking forward to Christmas. And this is, well, let's settle the bird debates first of all. What do you make on Christmas Day?
Well, I always do goose.
Yeah.
But I'm a big fan of goose. I think it's got a better flavour than turkey. It's more interesting. And also, I've been a bit patriotic. It's much more traditionally British to eat a goose. Turkey's an American bird, so... But I've got nothing against old turkey, as long as you've got a good one, but yeah.
A goose is a good one. I presumably there's the economy of scale here as well. Like how many geese are missing from the farm after a Ferguson Christmas dinner?
One goose feeds about 8 people, so there's about 6 of us in our family, so we probably need 2 geese.
Is that... and that's the thing, and you've brought some other bits and bobs with you.
I've got some bits and bobs with me,
I mean, you obviously, at Beagle, you've got a British charcuterie thing going on. Kind of introducing things that used to be on the menu and they're now coming back,
Yeah, no, exactly. Well, rather than buying charcuterie from France or Spain or Italy, I think it's becoming quite a thing to sort of have good British animals and make your own, So
Before we let Rob tuck in, can I ask you, so you've come through that kind of, you're associated with lots of the chefs who've done nose-to-tail eating.
Yeah.
And is that part and parcel of what the Beagle does as well?
It is. And that's part of how the charcuterie sort of comes around as well, really, because nose-to-tail obviously involves buying whole carcasses of animals, you know, pigs, rather than just buying a loin of pig, which is where everyone eats chops and things. You buy the whole animal and then you'd make every effort to use every part of it up. So all the bones, the head, you know, the tail. And from that, you get these very interesting cuts of charcuterie, which is something that was done more generations ago. Not particularly in this country, but quite a bit in this country. And it's sort of coming back. Good way of using things up.
I know much is discussed about the kind of nose-to-tail phenomenon, but for you, is it about kind of respect for the animal as well as kind of what we eat? Because I guess so much of the processing of animal carcasses means that tons of it gets thrown away, and you know, we're unused to kind of dealing with offal and kidneys and livers and all these
exactly.
things.
Exactly. The sad thing, I think in this country, we're very guilty of it. Maybe not so much in somewhere like France. I'm not a big France fan, trust me, but it's just a fact. Is that in supermarkets here, if you're most likely to buy bits of loin and bits of leg of pork, and then most of the belly or the shoulders either get sent abroad or it just gets minced up, because people just they sometimes don't know how to handle it, they don't know what to do with it. Now any chef will tell you that it's worth his salt that the best parts of the animal are the parts that get eaten least, like the, you know, roast pork belly is always infinitely better than loin.
And before I hand back to Rob, can I ask one question though? Is there a bit of the only thing that
is it my job just to eat?
I just got one follow up. The only thing that strikes me sometimes is, you know, I wonder if it's quite a guy's kind of world, this kind of, you know, eating all the bits of meat thing.
Do you think it is though?
Well, I don't know. I wonder, I want to ask you. I think that there's a bit of dare involved in some of it. Mm. You know, so, I couldn't agree more.
You know,
and
like,
I wonder whether that's a little bit alienating sometimes. It's not as embracing the whole movement as you'd hope it would be in a way.
Well, yeah, I think unfortunately there's always a bravado to the fact that if you put a big pig's head on the table, there's a certain type of man that will be like, whoa, you know, give us a pig's head, lovely. Do you know what I mean?
Yesterday.
Well, that's exactly. Right. But that's quite depressing to me in some ways, because I come from a working class family. My grandmother came from South Shields and she cooked bits of everything, and it wasn't a masculine thing. This is the fact that she didn't have a lot of money. Mm. She could cook. She didn't have the option of buying turkey Twizzlers. So she'd make brawn from a pig's head and some ox flank, you know, and right. You'd eat that. It was absolutely delicious. The comedy thing now is that, you know, restaurants are selling it at premium price to much more sort of upper working class people.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they're loving their.
I remember when we were kids, but you know, boiled hearts, livers, kidneys, the whole thing ended up
on. It's delicious, no? I think it's delicious.
Yeah, it's a funny thing. I wonder what you feel about that. The fact that we've, you know, the British palate, you know, it seems like a post-war thing has been kind of bred out of eating anything. Mm. We love a chicken breast. You know,
how depressing a chicken breast.
Exactly. How depressing is that? Ordering that in a
restaurant. It's the most depressing thing I ever see. Exactly. Every time I have to go in a supermarket, which isn't very much, and I see rows and rows of chicken breasts, I feel slightly suicidal. You know what I mean? Yeah. I just think this is what people want. They don't want to see where it's come from. They don't want to see a whole bird. They just want this lump of protein that they can eat.
Now, are you going to have some of this?
Yeah, let's have some of this.
You should have some
of this. Yeah, let's go a bit of it.
So you should tell.
Ooh, sorry about that.
No, it's good. Sound effects.
Sound effects.
I'll tell
you about a bit of this, because we make this. Most of it's pork based. I'll tell you that for a fact, because most charcuterie is. You get the odd bit made with kid, and all of this is apart from one really. So, if I hand you that over there. Okay.
Pass it to Mr. Band. He's going to be the taste tester.
You pick something up and he can taste it, and okay. I'll tell you what it is. So,
I'm going to pick up one of these. Yeah, this is a proper.
Okay, so that
sausage.
One over there, that is a straight up pork salami made with fennel. It uses the shoulder and it uses cured fat.
Mm. And the fat is delicious in that.
Yeah.
So sweet.
You know, the thing with charcuterie is it's sort of encouraging good bacteria to preserve the meat. So.
I need some of that.
God, it has an amazing smell.
Mm. Yeah, you get it straight away. Yeah. The one you can smell the most is these long strips that look like fat.
Now,
that's a pig's cheek.
Oh, is it?
That's a pig's cheek that's been cold smoked. It's been cured in salt and then cold smoked.
That's absolutely delicious.
They call it guanciale in Italian, but I just call it cured smoked pig's cheek. this is its British name.
I thought something poetic was going to trip off your tongue there, James. But I call it what it is, which is cured, salted pig's cheek. That is absolutely delicious. Yeah. There's a proper amazing smokiness out there. Talk to us about curing these meats, and is this something you do yourself? I live right next to a restaurant called Smokehouse in North London.
Yeah.
And I cannot walk past that place. They smoke everything out the back. Is that something that you
do? Yeah, we make our own, We have a cold smoker,
which
we built, which was quite interesting to do. We've got a lovely guy that we buy wood chips off. We smoke with apple wood and things like that.
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing.
So there's a smoking like that. But a lot of the charcuterie doesn't involve smoke. It involves encouraging the right bacteria at the right temperature and then having a room set around 18 degrees. We control quite well, and then you're always just testing the humidity and things in there, and you just basically make it and let it happen. That's what's interesting about it. And then 2 months later, hopefully, when you cut into it, you've got a lovely bit of charcuterie, you know.
And tell me, one of your predictions for 2015 is kid.
Yeah.
It's not young children, but this is literally.
Can I just tuck into this?
Yeah, help yourself.
For it.
Absolutely delicious.
Can we get some bread in here, please? Yeah.
And maybe a nice sort of slightly chilled Beaujolais.
is the return of goat to the menu? Why is this?
Yeah, well, kid's very, very ethical thing that we should be eating. I mean, I buy a kid off a young lad in Dorset, and he started going to what are dairy farms, where obviously loads of goat's milk, goat's cheese. What happens when a billy goat's born? Well, I'll tell you what happens. They just take it, bang it on the head, and throw it in a furnace. Well, that's what was happening. So he thought, well, this is a bit criminal, isn't it? Like, think how many, you know, equal amounts of boys and girls born. You're going to kill every male one. So he went around collecting them and rearing them for meat, really. So when I say kid, you know, I'm talking about a young animal still. It's sort of like 4 months, 5 months old when you get it. Same as lamb, I mean, and no one has a problem with lamb. And it's just got a very delicious flavour. Mm. And, you know, the more people eat it, the more readily available it become. It braises up lovely. A lot of restaurants in London are starting to see that now and sort of put it on the menu.
Has goat ever been much of a British meat? You only really see it here on menus for the, you know, the Caribbean
Mediterranean.
Yeah, well, actual full-grown goat is a very strong tasting meat and is good for curries and things like that, I believe. But it's not something I've used a lot.
Okay.
But actual younger goat kid is a much lighter looking meat and much more tender. You can grill it. It works really well off a wood grill, you know, and the shoulders and things braise slowly well.
And you've also tipped the Donna for
the Donna's going to come back.
Well, the Donna's always there, isn't it? But you've kind of tipped it for more.
I think calling it the Donna's a little bit.
That's what you've called it on the notes to our poor researcher.
Hey, sorry about that, but I didn't mean it. I didn't quite mean it like a Donna. More like Turkish food. But you know, you've got a lot of Turkish restaurants in East London, but just giving it a little bit more because they all do the traditional sort of Turkish thing. I know a couple of chefs of opening places where they're
going to
put their own thing. Yeah, exactly. Mm. And I think they'll do pretty well.
Mm.
Yeah.
That is absolutely delicious. Can I ask you about, we were talking about, you know, saying what's the point in buying Italian charcuterie? It's really expensive.
Yeah.
You could do your own. You know, you've seen the animal from which it's come. What about the writing of menus? I'm interested in, like, how you write a menu. I love Fergus Anderson's menus at St. John.
Yeah.
They simply list,
I mean, they are stone cold, really, aren't they?
They say four things. There's no adjectives.
Yeah.
And how do you get around that at Beagle? Are you interested in sort of telling people how long things have been aged for, saying that Daisy was very happy when she passed away, or what?
I don't. If someone comes and asks me, or they ask a member of staff there, they know all about it and they'll tell you. But actually, my wording on the menu is quite barren as well. It's not quite as barren as Fergus, who likes it'll be like, you know, beef and carrots.
Bream carrots, potatoes.
Sometimes, literally, that's all it is at St. John. I mean, that's what it's about, you know. But, if I listed charcuterie or something like that, I would say, you know, English meat board, and then I would say the things on it quite basically what they are, like I have to you when you've been eating them, you know.
This is so delicious.
Yeah.
It's best thing ever. Best guest of 2014. I love James Ferguson.
Best guest of 2014.
Yes. Love it. Amazing. It's more me than you.
It's more you than me.
Fantastic.
And James, finally, I think that I just wanted to ask you, in this kind of changing world of restaurants and what lies ahead, what's your prediction for your own business? How would you like to see your company grow and what you're doing?
Well, you know, we
TV chef.
TV chef, yeah, my own programme. I'd like to be like Jamie Oliver, you know. Well, the restaurant's constantly growing, you know. We sort of developed what we're doing. I mean, charcuterie a year ago, we started doing things, you know, going on that charcuterie, that's a charcuterie restaurant. But we're just sort of looking to sort of introduce people to a bit more of these foods that we do and just build our customer base.
Well, it's absolutely, that charcuterie is amazing. I'm going to get myself down to Beagle ASAP.
Look, if you wrap that up quick, you could give some as a Christmas present.
I don't think there's going to be any of it left after we left the studio, actually. I think that's definitely kind of, it's going to be nibbled underneath my desk. That's fantastic. It's so nice to meet you.
Cheers.
Thank you so much for your time talking through the menu at Beagle, Food Trends 2015, bringing the cold cuts in. It was absolutely fantastic. James Ferguson of Beagle in London. Thank you very much. Norman Mailer was perhaps one of the most talented, controversial and egocentric American writers of the past century. So it's not exactly a surprise that Mailer claimed an essay he wrote for Esquire magazine about JFK's 1960 presidential campaign had won the election for Kennedy. The extremely pro-JFK piece was published in Esquire just weeks before polls opened.
That piece, Superman Comes to the Supermarket, is now known as one of the most iconic pieces of the so-called New Journalism movement ever written. And now, in 2014, publishing house Taschen has transformed Mailer's essay into book form, very large book form, we should say, with 300 photographs from the campaign trail.
I'm pleased to say that Nina Weiner, managing editor at Taschen, who edited the book, joins us on the line from our New York bureau now. Nina, welcome to the programme. And first of all, do you think that Norman Mailer's essay helped win JFK the election that year?
Well, you know, Kennedy only won by 100,000 votes. Esquire's circulation was certainly in excess of 100,000 when you count all the people who might have passed the word on based on what they read. It's not entirely impossible.
And how on earth did you, I mean, this is a huge, handsome book from Taschen. I mean, it's a huge work of editing. As the editor of that book, obviously working with all the words and pictures, how on earth did you know what to leave out?
Well, you know, it's always a process of casting a wide net and then pulling back to hone in on the story. Mailer's essay really focuses on a specific moment in the campaign, namely the Kennedy's win at the Democratic National Convention in Los Angeles, where he takes the lead and selects Johnson as his running mate. And we decided that we would focus in on the book on the full year of the campaign, starting from the date that he announced his intention to run on January 2nd from the U.S. Senate floor, up through the inauguration. So already we narrowed the field of which images would be considered in the first place. We didn't want to get into his actual presidency. We didn't want to get into, of course, the assassination, which was so mm-hmm. widely covered. And we found that Life magazine in particular, which had so many great photojournalists working for it, had a real treasure trove of pictures, as did the John F. Kennedy Library. And then, of course, iconic photographers famous for capturing the Kennedy years, like Jacques Lowe and Stanley Tredick. We started with about 5,000 images and whittled our way back from there.
And Nina, what was it about this essay that I think in the introduction to the book it says it changed journalism as we knew it? What was so important about this essay?
Well, if you read any political writing, at least in the United States, prior to this, the language tends to be a little bit more on the dry side. It's very rare for the journalist to insert himself or herself into the story. And what Mailer really did was take Kennedy as this existential hero that had real hope and promise for America. It wasn't an opinion piece, but Mailer managed to inject his own personal hopes and dreams for the country into the story and really elevate the mythology surrounding this character who was widely unknown across the country before his presidential campaign. Of course, a huge figure in local Massachusetts politics and known throughout the Northeast, but not so well known across the country. And Mailer's use of the first person, injecting his self into the piece, really was a new form for journalism at this point. Of course, later in the 60s, you have writers like Hunter S. Thompson and Gay Talese and Tom Wolfe doing this with great regularity and really finding even more energetic and unique ways of writing about contemporary events around the world.
I mean, are you trying to sort of draw, does the book draw the line or draw the similarity between Naylor's new journalism, this was the sort of genesis of it, and JFK's maybe new politics, that these two people were both telling it like it was?
Absolutely. And the other thing that's so interesting, you have the rise of new journalism, but you also have television coming in as the dominant medium in the United States for getting a message out. And, you know, there was an interview with Kennedy just after the election where he said, without television, he probably wouldn't have won the election in the first place. If you listen to the two candidates in the general campaign, Kennedy and Nixon, of course, in a debate, for example, most people who were polled would say, the debate was really a tie. But if you watched the debates on television, that would have been the exact opposite. Kennedy killed it on the first debate with Nixon on television. Nixon looked sweaty. His makeup was terrible. He was fidgety. His eyes were shifting all over the place. He looked like a shady, untrustworthy character. And Kennedy came across as calm, cool, collected, and in command of the entire conversation. And I think the sort of the rise of new journalism, bringing new life to writing for major publications, and the rise of television very much come together hand in hand in this book.
Nina, obviously the book is a chance to republish this essay, but also really some extraordinary photographs from the campaign trail of JFK around that time, pictures of him with the likes of Sinatra when he was touching Hollywood, but also just amazing pictures of him on the hustings. And he comes across in the book as, you know, as a hero. I wonder if that stature that he has today, unfortunately, is connected to his assassination, and that a book like this only works really because of the terrible things that happened to JFK. He wasn't dented by old age. He wasn't dented even by some of the scandals we now know that were happening at the time to do with his love life. When you were putting this book together, were you cautious of, you know, building up too much of a heroic image of the man, or do you feel that this is actually a celebration of JFK the legend?
You know, we really wanted to focus in on this very hopeful moment in the campaign, not to whitewash his story, but this was the aspect of his story that we were telling. We don't get into his personal life in the book. There's a little bit with his family, but really to the extent that they were out in a public way campaigning for him. We don't get into the assassination. We don't get into his affairs. And certainly, you know, like Marilyn Monroe, like Bobby, his brother Bobby, like James Dean, like Martin Luther King, all these figures who sort of died tragically young, his myth has been magnified, but I don't know that the book in particular could have not worked if that hadn't been the case.
And just finally, Nina, we're going to go back to the backbone of the book, which is Mailer's essay. Does that still feel fresh to you? It felt fresh to me reading it, but I mean, obviously, it's been so often copied, that putting the journalist himself in the middle of the picture with that essay. If we were going to look at another perhaps iconic or certainly important president, President Obama, is there anything that matches up to that in your mind's eye as a brilliant piece of writing about the campaign trail? Was very much this quality of journalism, this length of journalism. And maybe some of the ego behind this type of journalism, a sign of those times that they aren't of these?
That's a very good question. You know, I mean, certainly the David Remnick's piece in The New Yorker during the campaign is the one story that I read during the Obama run that brings this that I think has any bearing. And one could say that Remnick has a bit of an ego on him, although it's hard to compete with Norman Mailer. but I think that there are other parallels to draw to Obama's campaign that struck me through the course of working on this book over the 2 years that I worked on it. Number one, I probably read the Mailer essay at least 20 times over the course of editing the book. Number two, I read a minimum of 500 of Kennedy's campaign speeches from the trail. And the John F. Kennedy Library in Boston has an enormous trove of this material. And what struck me over and over again was how similar some of the rhetoric was to the very words that were coming out of Obama's mouth during his campaign. Number three is the parallels between Kennedy's ability to harness the new medium of television and Obama's incredible knack for reaching out to the public through email and digital media. It was just a pretty astonishing parallel in terms of the machine that these two men were able to build up around them. Of course, it's necessary to win any high-level election, but that they were able to do something so fresh and new with their own outreach efforts.
Well, that's the next book sorted, Nina, as well, then. thank you very much for joining us. That was Nina Weiner there, managing editor at Taschen, on their new book about Norman Mailer and JFK.
Up next, we'll look at the colourful career of publisher, think tanker, and etiquette expert Eden Collinsworth.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
Back in 2011, Eden Collinsworth, a former publishing maverick, magazine founder and think tanker, moved to China. Like all good entrepreneurs, she was chasing a hunch, a gap in the market. With China's cultural and economic ties veering ever closer to the West, business people and students there, the idea went, want to know how Westerners act and think and why.
Eden's hunch proved to be massively on point. The result was her best-selling book, The Tao of Improving Your Likeability, a guide that's now used as a textbook in the MBA program at Peking University. The unlikely, often bizarre year that Eden spent in China has now been told in her new book, I Stand Corrected, How Teaching Western Manners in China Became Its Own Unforgettable Lesson.
Earlier this week on The Entrepreneurs, Eden explained the exploding business opportunities in China. Today, she explains to Monocle producer Daniel Giacopelli her colourful career path that led her to that country.
The reason that I ended up in book publishing was completely happenstance. There really was no reason other than the fact that I came to New York wanting to be a painter and I needed to earn a living and I couldn't type. And, you know, this was in the late 70s when, in fact, women, at any rate, were expected to type in order to get entry-level positions. And so because I couldn't, and I really tried my best, I couldn't get up to speed for whatever reason. I couldn't, don't know what you call it, it's blind typing, where you're not looking, but you're touch typing or something.
Right.
At any rate, I failed miserably. And so the only job that I could get, I couldn't get a permanent job. I went to what they call a temporary agency in New York. And they send you off kind of interim periods where people are taking vacations or wherever they need extra help. And in this particular case, literally the first job that I had was a 2-week stint covering for the receptionist at Doubleday on the executive floor, this wonderful, very proper little old lady who sat there with, almost frankly, she was wearing her white gloves at her desk. But because it didn't require typing, this is again, dates me, but it was, you would sit behind a desk and greet the guests and writers who came in. And phone the editors, the corresponding editors, and the only thing you could do was to read, and even then you could only read Doubleday books. So I thought it was the perfect job for me because I was always interested in reading and it didn't require typing. But then in ways that I can't begin to explain, but it required a great deal of luck and hard work. 8 years later, I was running a book publishing company called Arbor House, which was considerably smaller, but very lively.
8 years after you worked on that desk,
yes,
you were running a publishing house.
Yeah, so I was 21 or 20, and I was a book publisher at 29.
And then you started your own magazine.
Well, I worked at Arbor House for 10 years, and I left it in an act of kind of ignorance and optimism. I left it to start a magazine in Los Angeles, never having lived in Los Angeles, never having raised money, knowing nothing whatsoever about magazine publishing, and being, by the way, 8 months pregnant. So, but as a book publisher, I was coming in and out of Los Angeles on a, not often, but on a regular period. And I could see during the period of that 10 years that the city had become quite confident. And, you know, there's always an interesting dichotomy, or there certainly was at the time, between the coastal cities, or New York is fairly condescending towards Los Angeles. But for me, I saw it as an opportunity because from an editorial perspective, I saw that there were virtually no magazines. There was Los Angeles Magazine, I think In Style was, there was something called Egg, but there were no magazines that actually spoke to sophisticated editorial. They were full of advertising pages, but it wasn't a particularly engaged editorial. And then I also saw that in terms of the marketing of the city, there were all sorts of retail stores that were bubbling up, you know, high-end Tiffany, Barney's, so on and so forth. And there was really no print vehicle in which to advertise, no sophisticated. So I saw both an editorial and a business opportunity, and it was a deeply mad thing to do. But I think that's probably what is required as an entrepreneur. It's just that, you know, some level of tenacity.
I read you were rescued at the brink of disaster.
Absolutely.
And you managed to squeak on for another 8 years.
Yeah, well, you know, what had happened was I raised enough money and, you know, had a very interesting first tier group of investors. So Larry Ellison actually was one, Ted Field, who launched Interscope, and then another businessman who was involved here, actually out of London, you know, overseeing Smith Barney. And with that money, I was able to create a direct mail campaign. Again, this dates me because all of this was before, you know, web-based outreach. Based on that, I garnered, you know, a subscription base, so to speak. So I had a rate base. And I was able then to launch a first publication because we had, actually, it was an interesting situation where I assumed that I'd have local advertisers, but because of the appetite, I ended up getting very upscale national advertisers, primarily based out of New York. At any rate, I had only enough money to get that first issue out, and then the market crashed. It took this incredible dive of 500 points one day, and this again was before, now there's systems in place that literally shut the system, you know, you can no longer trade after it plummets to a certain degree. At any rate, no one knew what was happening, and all my first-tier investors who had committed to a large degree to reappear disappeared for understandable reasons. I couldn't reach anybody. But I was able to actually get a loan based on the ad commitments that I had for the second and third issue, because many of the advertisers had bought three issues. So they bought into rather than a single issue, three. And so I had that as collateral. And I got a loan to put out the next two. And still there were no people showing up as I worked away on you know, a second tier funding. And in a way that you cannot invent in fiction, we had one phone in this office, one desk and one chair. And the phone rang one day. And of course, I was the only one there to pick it up. And it turned out to be a man who had been in Hawaii on a vacation, who had picked up the magazine. I have no idea how it got to Hawaii. I didn't even know at that point we had distribution in that state. And he was looking at the time, he was representing a Time mogul, a media mogul based in both Hong Kong and Bangkok. And he was representing this man looking for opportunities in which to invest specifically in Los Angeles, because there was a general sense that this was the Pacific Rim was becoming progressively more important. This man had the unlikely name, this Thai mogul, of Santi Limthanku. And so at the last minute, I was rescued by, you know, a stranger in a foreign land. It was quite remarkable. And he was a wonderful investor. He actually became, within the last 5 and 6 years, became very involved in the political movements and was overseeing what they call the Yellow Shirt Movement. So he became politically very involved. But, you know, it was a wonderful experience.
You speak of him in your book in the introduction, I believe.
Yes.
When you were speaking with your son.
Yes.
That's and exactly you were planning right. to travel to Bangkok to meet him, but he got shot.
Yes.
So you couldn't do that.
And this is all part of the... We shouldn't be laughing. He did. He was shot.
Yeah.
He was survived it. Unfortunately, sadly, his driver was killed. But so the first chapter in my book that is now out was a conversation I was having with my son. And I have brought my son up primarily on my own. Certainly the last 15 years, I've been his only parental guidance. And so he has, just as I have moved around the world, so too has my son, Gilliam. And so he, at the time we had this phone conversation, had graduated from or had attended a Japanese university to learn Japanese. I had put him through grade school. He had gone through the Lycée system, so he was French-speaking. But he went to Japan to learn Japanese, and with that, he applied to SOAS here in London, which is the School of Oriental and African Studies, to concentrate on Chinese. And the time at which we had this conversation, he was actually in China. And we were meant to go to Bangkok for his birthday at the invitation of Santi Limthanku, and Santi had been shot. And so the conversation I was having with my son at the time was that obviously our plans, our travel plans, were changing, and he suggested that he would prefer not visiting my friends who incited political riots in foreign countries.
So why not come to Beijing, I guess, was the ultimate gist. And he made an observation to you that where he was studying, the students tended to be a bit socially disconnected.
Yes. Well, quite honestly, as a result of my 35-year career, I was initially a book publisher. I launched a magazine. And once I sold the magazine, the chairman of Hearst invited me back and created a role. And so for those 10 years, I was, in fact, moving in and out of China on a regular basis, looking for opportunities on behalf of the Hearst Corporation. And I had come to the same conclusion my son had. From a business perspective, I realized that no matter how well educated, and by that I don't, you know, I mean in the Western sense, how English speaking my colleagues were in China, they were, I could tell, you know, from a visceral sense, they were uncomfortable, not entirely comfortable, you know, in the company of their Western counterparts. And so it was interesting to hear from my son that even his age group at the time, I think he was 18, that there was a certain social discomfort. And so we both came to the conclusion that there might be an opportunity to, whether it's a program or a book, to offer Chinese, and by that I mean mainland Chinese, because it's quite different in Hong Kong, an opportunity to learn more about Western etiquette, for want of a business word. From my perspective, it was also business practices. And so that actually gave me the idea of writing a book, which required me then to move to Beijing and work with a Chinese publisher. So unbeknownst to me at the time, it was, I think, the first time a Western writer had shown up, frankly, unsponsored, which was enough to put me on their radar screen, and work collaboratively with a Chinese publisher to write a book in Chinese for Chinese. Typically what happens is that you write a book, it's translated, it may or may not be tampered with by the censor, and then it's published. This was a very different approach.
It's a top-down kind of approach.
Yes, and you know, you may know that for the most part, the publishing houses in China are, well, they're all state-controlled, but many of them are state-owned. And so, not surprisingly, the government is extremely alert to any Western participation in media in general. One can only, as a Western investor, even at a corporate level, you can only own a certain percent. You always must have a Chinese partner. And so I was, you know, a peculiarity enough to be put on the, you know, some version of their watch list, again, unbeknownst to me.
Eden Collinsworth there, author of I Stand Corrected, How Teaching Western Manners in China Became Its Own Unforgettable Lesson. One of the longest titles we've ever had on the show, possibly, Andrew. With Monocle's Daniel Giacopelli there. And that is all for edition 285 of the Monocle Weekly, Andrew. That was a good one, wasn't it?
I loved it.
I've eaten my full of cold cuts.
You've still got a little bit of meat stuck between your teeth. You're sucking away at your molars.
I think I've had quite a long week. I'm feeling a bit toothachey. I don't know what to do.
I like the fact when you've had a big week, you're always worried your teeth are going to fall out.
Porridge for Christmas.
I've had this conversation with you like several times over several years.
I know,
like,
I get a bit worried.
Do you think
my
teeth are going to fall out?
Let's talk about one of the highlights of the week, very briefly before we go, which was the Monocle and Wink Creative Christmas party happening on Monday night.
It turned into a bit of a kind of like Greek wedding at the end with you raised on a chair being danced around the room.
I couldn't remember that happening until someone put a picture of it, until Holly Fisher put a picture of it on Facebook.
Okay, and there you were being
hoisted
aloft.
There's a video. It was to Frank Sinatra's New York. Yeah. That's the way to finish a party.
And you looked very, very happy up there, banging your head on the chandelier.
I thought I'd do that instead of having a review.
Yes, that was
what more can I give?
It was a very nice end to the year. So thank you to Emily Smith and all the team who organised.
Yeah.
A very nice Christmas bash.
It was decent, wasn't it?
And I hope everyone else is going to have a nice end of year as well.
Yeah, let's wish everybody a Merry Christmas. Let's also thank our team behind the glass today. The show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli and our studio manager was Claire Urban. Andrew and I will be back same time next week, next year in fact. But for the time being, from me, Robert Bounds.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Merry Christmas. And to play us out for this year, here's Frank Sinatra from 1960, that vintage year when he supported JFK's campaign trail. Here he is with Nice and Easy.
Let's take it nice and easy. It's gonna be so easy for us to fall in love. Hey baby, what's your hurry? Relax and don't you worry. We're gonna fall in love. Safe to say, but let's make all the stops along the way. The problem now, of course, is to simply hold your horses. To rush would be a crime. Along the way, the problem now, of course, is to simply hold your horses. To rush would be
be a crime. 'Cause nice and easy does it. Nice and easy does it. Nice and easy does it every time. Like the man says one more time. Nice and easy does it. Nice and easy.